you make that sound like it's an easy question. Like, this is the starter question, but it's actually very hard.
So that's a good question. I think free will is...
What free will is actually a pretty complicated question.
So what is free will?
Hello, this is Free Will Matters. My name is Santiago Amaya, and I'm an associate professor in philosophy at Universidad de los Andes in Bogotá. I am the host of this podcast.
Hi, I'm Manuel Vargas, and I'm a professor of philosophy at the University of California, San Diego. I am also the host of this podcast.
The human ability to decide and act freely requires that we think of ourselves as agents of a particular kind. We must have the ability to form intentions, to deliberate, to exercise self-control, plan for the future, and so on. At the same time, we are creatures bound by the context and the circumstances that we occupy. What kind of agents, then, are we? How is our agency shaped by the world in which we live? For this season, our guests will be distinguished authors and researchers working on the philosophy of agency. The philosophy of agency can be a daunting endeavor, but with their help, we will get to know better the what, the how, and the why of our agency. Welcome.
For today's episode, our guest is Kevin Timpey. Kevin is the William H. Jellema Chair of Christian Philosophy at Calvin College. He's the author and editor of 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11 books, including Free Will, Sourcehood, and Its Alternatives, arguing about religion, free will and theism, virtues and their vices, among others. His most recent book, Disability and Inclusive Communities, is now available in better bookstores everywhere. In addition to being an extraordinarily productive philosopher, Kevin is also a disability inclusiveness advocate, and he's got a remarkable record of service to this community. Welcome.
Welcome, Kevin.
Thank you for having me.
Kevin, so last time you visited our podcast, we talked about your work in free will. But this time, we're going to be talking about another major interest of yours, disability and its connections to agency. So let's start, as philosophers are said to do, by defining our terms. How should we define disability? Is there a difference between disability and impairment? Between disability and disease?
So if you're hoping to begin by the standard philosophical question of defining our terms, I'm going to give you the standard philosophical answer that is probably going to disappoint you by not providing the sort of answer that you're looking for, in part because I don't think that we can. I've got a paper coming out sometime in the philosophical community sense of sometime, which argues that what we mean by disability is context specific. And so if we want to use the term disability, it's usually within the context of a certain kind of conversation or a certain set of concerns. And those concerns shape how we understand the nature of what disability is. So for instance, one of the most influential definitions of disability here in the United States is what's enshrined in our disability civic protection law, the Americans with Disabilities Act. It defines a disability as a physical or mental impairment that substantially limits one or more major life activities, a history of such an impairment, or being regarded as having a disability. So what's really interesting to me in terms of this legal definition, you don't even have to be a certain way in order to qualify as having a disability. You just have to be regarded by enough people as having that. Well, why is the law written that way? Well, the purpose of the law is to give people certain kinds of legal and civic protection. So you can't get fired for having a disability, for instance. And so they wrote the definition to be very broad so that, for instance, you couldn't be fired from a job for having extreme facial scarring, even if that scarring didn't impact one or more of your major life activities. In other contexts, we might want to have a different understanding of what disability is. And so the definition is used for a purpose that I think shapes what sort of definition is going to be an acceptable one in that particular context. And this is true not only, I think, with disability itself, but even with regard to specific disabilities. So to take one like autism, there are two major definitions of autism in US usage, one of which is the one that is enshrined in the Diagnostics and Statistics Manual, which is like the psychological Bible of various kinds of mental illness and neurodiversity subjects. The other is what is defined in the US's law that protects disabled students in terms of access to their education, the Individuals with Disabilities Education Act. So they both give a definition of what autism is, but the definitions aren't the same. You can qualify as having autism under the DSM-5 and not qualify as being autistic under the Individuals with Disabilities Education Act. And in principle, even though I've not met anybody for whom this is the case, you might qualify as being autistic under IDEA and not qualify under the DSM. Because the DSM has a certain purpose, right? It wants to diagnose what it understands as mental illnesses for various purposes of treatment. The Individuals with Disabilities Education Act wants to define disabilities for the purpose of giving them access to education that they might otherwise be denied. And so the purposes shape how they understand what something like autism is. And again, I think that generalizes to what disability is more broadly. In none of my work do I use the specific definition of impairment as contrasted with disability. That's the distinction between impairment and a disability is enshrined in the Americans with Disabilities Act definition of what a disability is. To have a disability under the ADA requires a physical or mental impairment that limits one or more major life activities. So if you don't have an impairment, you can't have a disability under that part of the definition. But it never defines what it means by an impairment, which is in a sense, right, from a philosophical point of view, super unhelpful. So I think that what I often do in my work is rather than to try to give a definition that establishes the boundaries, is to use paradigmatic cases of the kinds of disabilities that we are looking at for the project and say, by disability, I mean these sorts of things. And then you give a relevant list and other things that are sufficiently like them to be relevant to the discussion here. But I think that giving exact boundaries of either disability or impairment get really, really difficult and probably aren't going to track the way the world is in terms of capturing some kind of out there in the world criteria. Another way to say this is I think that both disability and impairment are socially constructed categories, that we, in certain ways, construct what those terms mean by the use that we put them as communities.
How we think about disability has real-life consequences. Bad thinking about disability can have bad consequences for individuals and communities. We're going to talk about that shortly. But before we get to it, we want to ask you about its theoretical significance. What are the most significant things that philosophers of action, or really philosophers in general, can learn from a good theory of disability?
Here I've been shaped by work by David Shoemaker, among others. David Shoemaker has a really interesting book called Responsibility from the Margins. And he argues that when we want to think about something like responsibility, we typically look at just the paradigmatic cases. And those might give us a lot of what we're looking for, but they might leave off interesting complications, counterexamples, further bits that we would benefit from if we look at what he calls marginal cases. And so I think that a lot of times we construct theories of moral responsibility or action theory by looking at these paradigmatic cases, but they might not give us a full understanding of what we're looking for. And in fact, I think that we can actually learn something about the standard cases that we might otherwise overlook by looking at and paying more careful attention to some of the marginal cases, as Shoemaker uses the term.
Kevin, let me ask you a question with respect to what you just said. Agency has connection with some ideals, some of which are very dear to us. The ideal of happiness and flourishing, for example. Can you tell us a little bit about the relationship between these ideals and your thinking about disability? How does disability impact, if it does, our ideals of flourishing and happiness? In other words, what can happiness theories learn from a good theory of disability?
I think that's a good question. I think that a lot of folks have this assumption that every disability is going to be contrary to their happiness or flourishing in some sort of way, right? It's this unstated assumption that to be disabled is bad for you and the people around you in some way. And this comes out in everyday conversations. If you talk as a new parent, for instance, to somebody and they ask how your new child is doing and you say, well, we just figured out that they have a disability diagnosis. The answer you almost, the next words out of the other person's mouth almost always are, I'm sorry, right? There's this assumption that the individual is going to be worse off because of that disability diagnosis. And I think that careful reflection on disability studies and philosophy of disability can call that into question. There's really good empirical work, for example, that many disabilities don't have the kind of negative impact on people's subjective well-being or happiness that we think that it does. The data suggests that the process of going from being non-disabled to acquiring a disability, especially if it's a significant or severe disability, does impact people's subjective well-being or happiness, but only for a while. And then the curve comes back. And depending on the study, after 3 to 5 years, you're either as happy as you were prior to acquiring the disability, or very close to as happy, or in some studies, even happier, right? So I think that the kind of work in careful reflection of disability can show us that we are pre-theoretical judgments about what is going to make us happy are often vastly mistaken. We can also learn that happiness is a lot more flexible of a concept than we might initially think. Right? We might think that in order to be happy, you know, there's a list of, I don't know, 7 or 12 goods that are required for us to be happy. But we often think about what those goods are as just coming in sort of the modality that they most likely come in. So for instance, lots of people think that if they were to become deaf and thus not able to interact with other people verbally in the way that they're used to, that their life would be way worse off than it is. But what we learn is what's important for our happiness isn't necessarily the ability to communicate verbally or orally with other people, but the ability to communicate, right? And so what is needed is a lot more flexible than we might not think. And in fact, if you look at people that use sign language, there are certain kinds of benefits to sign language that aren't a part of normal verbal oral communication. And so there might be ways in which looking carefully at disabilities can show us that certain goods that we want out of life that we think will contribute to our happiness might actually come in more varieties or modalities than we're used to. And that can help us have a broader understanding. So for instance, if I were to be fluent in American Sign Language, I could have a conversation with my spouse from across the room at a dinner party. And I could tell her, this is a dinner party, I'm socially awkward, I want to leave. And I could do that from across the room without having to either yell it in the middle of the party or without having to walk across and interrupt the conversation she's having. So that would be a really useful skill to have. And that might make my dinner party experiences better, but we often don't think that sign language would have that kind of benefit. We think about it instead as a stopgap measure if something bad happens to us. And I think that that's the wrong way to think about it.
Kevin, what's the most common mistake that philosophers make when they talk about disability?
I don't know that there's a single most common mistake. I mean, maybe there is, but I haven't done the empirical work, sociological work to know what that is. But there are a number of very common ones. One of the assumptions that a lot of philosophers, as well as a lot of just everyday lay individuals make thinking about disability, is that disability is always bad, that having or acquiring a disability always makes your life worse. And so you see that in philosophers as well. I think another mistake that people make is that they're in a good position without direct firsthand knowledge of what life with that disability is like to make pronouncements about that life. Philosophers, this will surprise you, sometimes are a little over ambitious in their ability to understand and pronounce on parts of the world that they do not have close experience with. And so you often have people making claims about particular disabilities or life with a disability that just seem completely unrooted in actual lived experience of the people that have those particular conditions. And a third mistake that I'll mention that I think a lot of philosophers make is to think that any philosophical point made using one sort of disability applies equally to all other sorts of disability, right? So disability gets flattened in a way that its impact on a particular issue or understanding is the same in all sorts of cases. And I think that's to fail to understand the diversity and breadth of what disability is and its effect on our lives.
So Kevin, during the last years, your work has transitioned from themes in the philosophy of free will to disability theory. And that's quite an interesting change. So the free will is about idealized agents, the metaphysical structure of the world. Whereas when we talk about disability theory, we're talking about real individuals and their lives and the concrete ways in which social structure shape their lives. So I want to ask you this question. How does this transition have an impact in the way you think about humanity or about human beings?
That's a really good question. It's affected how I think about humanity in a number of different ways. One way that it has done it is I used to be what is sometimes called an ideal theorist. I used to think that what we're doing in philosophy is only looking at sort of what the ideal cases are, right? And again, so in the free will literature, we often have these very idealized assumptions about what human agents are, their capacities, their cognitive access to various kinds of things. You know, my work now has made me much more of a non-ideal theorist. I think that when we theorize, we have to take seriously not just the ideal that we're aiming for, but the various constraints we have in the very real world that we live in. And that contrast between idealized approaches and non-idealized approaches is pretty prominent in political philosophy, but it started to shape how I think about things like ethics and even sort of the metaphysics of agency in important ways. So that's one way. Another way is I've become a lot more influenced by a range of views that are sometimes put under the umbrella of standpoint theory or feminist approaches to various issues. Those kinds of approaches to philosophical questions that don't pretend that we can approach the issue divorced from the location that we have in the social institutions that we're from and participate in. And so it might be that once we start taking disability seriously, we recognize that there might be aspects of other people's lived experiences that we have never thought about because we ourselves don't have a disability. And so we need to shift what kind of weight we give to various people's input. So if we want to talk about the way that disability affects human happiness, for instance, the best way to do that isn't to sit in our comfy armchairs in our offices and just think about these things. We're going to have to go out and interact with people that have disabilities and figure out the specifics of what their disability is and how it shapes their lived experiences.
In addition to being a full-time philosophy professor, you're also a disability and inclusiveness advocate. Can you give our listeners a sense about the kinds of challenges you've encountered in your advocacy work? Maybe what the biggest challenge you face is in doing that kind of work?
So most of my advocacy work has involved going in with families into schools to try to make sure that disabled children get the kinds of services and treatment that is required by law here in the United States and actually aligns more closely with what the educational literature tells us is good for our children than some of the actual experiences that kids are made to have. And one of the biggest frustrations I have with schools, and actually I had this in two separate school meetings that I was a part of yesterday, is that when you tell a school that what they're doing isn't either what's best for the student or actually legal, they default to their intentions. Well, we didn't mean to do that. And you can end up segregating disabled kids, even if that's not what you set out to do as your intention. So for instance, if you set up a field trip where you're taking a bunch of kids, school class, to go play competitive sports at the local beach, involving relay races and various kinds of things like that, you might do that just thinking, hey, this is, you know, like kids like the beach and it's nearby and let's go have a fun day at school. But any kid that uses a wheelchair or a walker is probably going to have a hard time at the beach unless they have access to a sand-based wheelchair. Kids with various social impairments might not have any interest or even awareness of the nature of competitive tasks. Even structuring children's activities in terms of competition and winning is going to disadvantage and leave out some kids. And so you can have an entire fun day for a kid's school based around a set of activities that ends up leaving out 5, 10, 15% of the class. And nobody thought we're going to invent a field trip that, you know, sort of disadvantages the disabled kids, but that's what they've done. And so this move to our intentions are enough to establish the appropriateness of our social policies is one of my really big frustrations that I encounter in my advocacy work.
So let me ask you one last question. So many of our listeners might be interested in doing advocacy work, but perhaps have no idea where to start. So can you give us any tips in this regard? If I want to begin doing this kind of work, where do I begin?
I think the best place to begin is by listening carefully to and taking seriously the people that you want to advocate for's thoughts on the particular issue. For many of us, we don't have disabled individuals in our lives, or we might not be aware of their disabilities. And so we might not be able to recognize what kinds of advocacy work they need. And so, right, talk to your autistic friends, talk to your mobility impaired friends, talk to your deaf and hard of hearing friends about how conferences leave them out. A lot of times here in the United States, every state has a local disability advocacy network instead of services. You could find out what your local one is and contact them and begin by volunteering. For us, we started doing it, for my wife and I, just when we realized that the school was violating our son's legal access to his education. And we didn't know where to begin, except as a philosopher, I'm pretty good at reading, understanding, and arguing. So I just downloaded the state special education disability manual, read it, and I came to realize pretty quickly that I knew the law better than some of the teachers who were tasked with actually educating our disabled son. And as a philosopher, I'm not particularly hesitant to make arguments, even if people aren't going to like the conclusions of those arguments. And so that's what I've done. And so what I've been trying to do more recently is to train other folks to do the same kinds of thing. So look around your local community, see where folks are being mistreated by the social structures, see where the kind of advocacy work that you want to be involved in is getting done, and plug yourself into those spaces.
Thank you for being with us, Kevin.
Very welcome. Thank you for having me.
That was awesome. Thank you.
Free Will Matters is part of the LATAM Free Will Agency and Responsibility Project. It is produced by 070, thanks to a generous grant of the John Templeton Foundation, and with the support of Universidad de los Andes and the University of California in San Diego. For more information, visit us at freewill.uniandes.edu.co. That is freewill.uniandes.edu.co.